Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Today I'm pleased to have as my guest Ian Rankin, the author of the best-selling Inspector Rebus series. Today we'll be discussing Flesh Market Alley, the 15th in the Rebus series, published by Little Brown, currently available in bookstores. And to begin the interview, I've asked Mr. Rankin to read the first page of Flesh Market Alley, because in the first page, I think he does what all good writers do. He tells us a little bit about the story, and he pulls us in with the plot. And as soon as he's done reading the first page, we'll discuss what makes it so special. So without anything further from me, I give you Ian Rankin.
The past 8 years had seen itself reorganized. As a result, it no longer boasted a CID office, meaning Rebus and his fellow detectives had been cast adrift, shipped out to other stations. He'd ended up at Gayfield Square, just off Leith Walk, a cushy number, according to some. Gayfield Square was on the periphery of the elegant new town, behind whose 18th and 19th century facades anything could be happening without those outside being any the wiser. It certainly felt a long way from Knoxland, further than the 3 factual miles. It was another culture, another country. Knoxland had been built in the 1960s, apparently from papier-mâché and balsa wood. Walls so thin, you could hear the neighbours cutting their toenails and smell their dinner on the stove. Patches of damp bloomed on its grey concrete walls. Graffiti had turned the place into hard Knox. Other embellishments warned the packies to get out, while a scrawl that was probably only an hour or so old bore the legend, "One less." What shops there were had resorted to metal grills on windows and doors, not even bothering to remove them during opening hours. The place itself was contained, hemmed in by dual carriageways to north and west. The bright-eyed developers had scooped out subways beneath the roads. Probably in their original drawings, these had been clean, well-lit spaces where neighbours would stop to chat about the weather and the new curtains in the window of number 42. In reality, they'd become no-go areas for everyone but the foolhardy and suicidal, even in daytime. It was probably those same bright-eyed developers who'd had the idea of naming the estate's various high-rise blocks after Scottish writers, and appending each with the word house, serving merely to rub in that these were nothing like real houses. Barry House, Stevenson House, Scott House, Burns House, reaching skywards with all the subtlety of single-digit salutes. Rebus looked around for somewhere to deposit his half-empty coffee cup. He'd stopped at a baker's on Gorgie Road, knowing that the further from the city centre he drove, the less likely he would be to find anything remotely drinkable. Not a good choice. The coffee had been scalding at first, quickly turning tepid, which only served to highlight its lack of anything resembling flavour. There were no bins nearby. No bins at all, in fact. The pavements and grass verges, however, were doing their best to oblige. So Rebus added his litter to the mosaic, then straightened up and pushed his hands deep into his coat pockets. He could see his breath in the air.
Thanks a lot, Ian. I appreciate you reading such a lengthy passage, but I think that with that being the start of Flesh Market Alley, the reader who is new to the Inspector Rebus series is going to learn a lot about Edinburgh and Rebus in a relatively short period of time. And in any good crime series, the city in which the series takes place becomes a central character, and that certainly isn't the case of Edinburgh in your novel. And you mentioned some of the famous city fathers in that opening. And why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the references you've made? And this was from the 18th century in Scotland, some of these names.
Yeah, well, Knoxland itself, which is K-N-O-X, is named after a famous churchman and writer who was famously and ferociously anti-Catholic and anti-women and anti just about everything. He once wrote a pamphlet called The Monstrous Regiment of Women. He was a Calvinist. He was a kind of dark and dour sort of guy. And some of the city, I think, still has that characteristic to it. I mean, the writers, you know, you can't live in Edinburgh or have spent any time there as a writer and not be aware of your heritage. There, you know, you, as you arrive. Louis Stevenson's house from when he was a kid. You're aware that people like Scott and Stevenson, Robert Burns spent a lot of time there, and of course J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan, was also an Edinburgh writer, as was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We forget that, we tend to forget that, but he was born and grew up in Edinburgh. So I wanted to kind of flag that up, that Edinburgh is a place of culture. Now, of course, the clash then is with the city that Rebus tends to police, which of course is the city of the have-nots, the city of the losers, the down-and-outs, the dregs. Rebus doesn't always get to see what a beautiful city he lives in, because to him it's just a series of crime scenes waiting to happen.
Yes, and the literary history continues today, which is must be an exciting place to be living today. There, in addition to yourself, you have some other famous writers that are living there now, I believe. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, well, when I started writing books in Edinburgh about Edinburgh in the early 80s, there didn't seem to be anybody writing about Edinburgh, or indeed anybody writing in contemporary Edinburgh. The modern Edinburgh novel at that time was The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie by Muriel Spark, which was published in 1961 and set in the 1930s. Since then, since the 80s when I started writing, there's been an explosion of talent, and in the very street that I live in, I live two doors away from Alexander McCall Smith, the author of the number one ladies detective agency books. So he's two doors away, and at the top of our street and round the corner, literally a 2-minute walk, is J.K. Rowling's home. So you've got three writers within 100 yards of each other. And because of that, the area that I live in is now, the locals call it Writer's Block.
What's it like with J.K. Rowling right now? Is that kind of crazy living there right now? I mean, are there fans there in droves?
No, I mean, I think part of the reason why she continues to live in Edinburgh is that, you know, in Edinburgh you're allowed a measure of privacy. You could be Sean Connery walking down the main street and people would say, "Hey, how you doing, Sean?" But no one's really going to hassle you. She's had one stalker who had to be deported. It was an American woman. But apart from that, she keeps herself to herself. She comes into the local cafe. I see her in there occasionally. She has a quiet family life, and she manages to get a lot of writing done, which is great.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. One of the things I liked about Flesh Market Alley is you broke the book up into 10 days. And stylistically, when you started the novel, Ian, why did you decide that, or when did you decide that you would clearly delineate the days that that make up the story of Flesh Market Alley?
Several reasons. I mean, number one, by breaking it up into days, that just keeps me clear in my own mind, because it's quite easy to keep, you know, once you're on the roller coaster that is a twisting mystery plot, it's very easy to lose track of the days, and you find that you've got your detective working 7 days straight, which of course in reality they never would. You know, they're working through Saturday and Sunday, you just don't realise it's a Saturday or a Sunday. So breaking up into days is useful for that. However, I never really plan these things in advance. I didn't plot the book out and say, okay, it's going to take place over 10 days and here's what's going to happen on each day. It just so happened that it took 10 days for the story to tell itself. So, I mean, it wasn't pre-plotted to that extent. It was just a useful way of me keeping track of what Rebus would be doing on any given day. And it's quite nice to have that kind of tight structure anyway. I mean, in reality, of course, we know that police investigations usually take a lot longer than that. But readers quite like it that it's contained in a short period of time. In previous books, you know, I've had books where it's only taken 5 or 6 or 7 days to wrap everything up, which readers seem to like. They like that kind of tight containment of time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I enjoyed, too, about this was it. Rebus is one of the things I like about the Inspector Rebus series, and this is, I believe this is number 15 in the series, isn't it, Ian?
You would know better than me.
Okay, yeah, it's 15. Is you've allowed Rebus to age in the series. Lawrence Block has done that with Matt Scudder, but not a lot of series writers allow their characters to age. And with Flesh Market Alley, I found it interesting. By the end of the day, Rebus is kind of tired, and Siobhan, his partner, who is almost gets equal billing in this book, to me it was very I could see how much that she cared for him and he for her, because she kind of knows when he's getting tired at the end of the day, and I thought that added a depth to the novel, because you could you realize that you're kind of tired in the morning, and you do get worn out at night. And how do you end your days? I thought that added an element to the novel, which I really enjoyed.
Well, this was a conscious decision on my part from very early on in the series. When I wrote the very first novel, Knots and Crosses, I had no idea it was the first book in a series. I'd written a novel before that was a standalone. I wrote Knots and Crosses. I went off and did a couple of thrillers. And I only slowly came back to Rebus because there were things about him that were still unsaid. He had got beneath my skin as a character. And by the time I was two or three books in, I suddenly realised, oh, this is a series now. At that point, I didn't think, okay, how many books am I going to write in the series? I had no set number. I just thought, as long as I can think of new things to find out about him and new things to say about Edinburgh, I will continue to write the books. However, having decided that he would live in real time, you know, the clock was already ticking, and I'd made him 40 in the first novel, which means he's now up in his mid to late 50s, and I discovered that if you're a detective in Scotland, you have to retire at 60. So he's only really got a few more books, a few more years left in him, which may explain the prominence that is beginning to be given to Siobhan. Maybe she's my insurance policy, so that if and when he does retire, she can carry the series and he can be in the background doing all her dirty work, because he's no longer a cop. He can break as many rules as he likes.
I think that sounds great, and I think that her evolution as a character has been one of the most satisfying parts of the series over the last few books. She's really taken on a stronger presence in the books, and to me,
I'm doing something a few writers of series ever do. At the moment, I'm rereading all my books in chronological order. Never having done that. I mean, once I've written a book and it's published, usually that's the end of it. I'm on to the next project. But I'm writing a book I'm about to start writing a book called Rebus's Scotland, which is a non-fiction book, which is partly my autobiography, partly his biography, how I came to write the books, with lots of black, sort of atmospheric black and white photographs of locations used in the series. Now, to prepare for that, I've been reading the books in order, and what I find in the early books is that there are very few strong women characters, because I felt I wasn't confident about writing from a woman's perspective, and especially a woman cop. And then what happened was that women crime writers, people like Val McDermott and Ruth Rendell and others, would say, oh, hey, we like what you do with these characters. And so did women police officers. They started, they would come and get books signed and say, oh, we like Jill Temple, we like Siobhan Clark, are you going to do more with them? And so I started to grow a bit in confidence. And at the same time, Siobhan started life as just another colleague, just someone else that could be at Rebus's police station. But something about her again got beneath my skin and demanded that I explore her character more, because there's so much I can do with her. She's a woman in what is still thought of as a man's job. There's a glass ceiling there that she wants to break through. She's college educated, which Rebus isn't. She's computer literate, which Rebus isn't. He's a bit of a dinosaur. So the two of them spark off each other quite nicely. She's also got a Gaelic Celtic name, but she's got an English accent, so I can talk about racism and xenophobia in Scotland. So there's so much I can do with her that she complements Rebus quite nicely.
Yes, absolutely. You mentioned a name there, Val McDermott, and if the listeners are not familiar with Val's work, I would strongly recommend her novels, particularly A Place of Execution. That seemed to be a quantum leap for her in the book. Since then, I thought it's just been fantastic. So there's a Scottish writer we'll give a plug to.
I like Val's work. I mean, it's funny. I think partly because there's this weird thing where there's no tradition of the mystery novel in Scotland. Scotland never had an Agatha Christie, a Marjorie Allingham, a Chandler or a Hammett. I think because of that, because there are no rules laid down as to the kind of mystery novel you should write, suddenly Scotland is full of very good mystery writers. There's Val McDermott and myself. We've got people like Chris Brookmeyer, Denise Mina, Louise Welsh. I mean, I could keep going. Quentin Jordan, Paul Johnson. Lots and lots of them who write we all write very different kinds of books: police procedurals, historical, books set in the future, sort of very tongue-in-cheek, dark, kind of Carol Hiaasen-type satirical novels, just about every kind of subgenre you can imagine. Because I think there are no rules, because the ghost of Agatha Christie is not sort of tapping us on the shoulder saying, no, you need to write a certain kind of book.
That's good. I'd like to ask you, we'll be getting into Flesh Market Alley here, but this is true of all the books in the series. There are some in the past, there have been some Scottish novels that I've read where the dialect kind of got in the way of my reading and kind of broke the narrative flow. That does not happen when I read your books or when I read Val McDermid's books, but particularly when I read an Ian Rankin novel, and I think this might be particularly helpful for listeners, is it very much reads, and I don't mean to say that it reads like an American crime novel at all, but I don't get hung up on any of the words. And is that something that you intentionally do, Ian, or is that just come naturally to you to write like that?
I think there may be several reasons for that. Early on in my career, there was a resurgence. When I was a student and I was desperately trying to be a writer of short stories and novels, there was a resurgence in writing in Scots. People like Alistair Gray and James Kelman came along, and then Trainspotting came along. And these were all books that were written in this dialect. Very difficult even for Scottish people sometimes to read. And I remember taking a James Kelman novel home to my dad. I thought, my dad's a good working class guy, he's going to enjoy this, it's a novel about a working class guy. But because it was written in Glasgow dialect, my father couldn't understand it. And I realised that all the books my dad read, he read books in English, and he would put his own voices in there, he would put his own intonations and his own dialect in there if he wanted to. So I made a conscious decision to write mostly in received English, in proper English. Now, having said that, Scots words creep into my stories all the time, but I'm always very careful to make sure that they're explained by their context. So even if you don't know what iron brew is, you know, you will know from the context that it's something people drink and it's not an alcoholic drink. And basically it's a fizzy, sweet, Scottish soft drink that's a very good hangover cure. I do go to efforts to make that happen. Also, my American publishers will ask me, they'll say, look, do we need to explain this word a little bit? Do we need to maybe change it a little bit? Just to make it, you know, that little bit easier for readers. I mean, I know a lot of readers in the States and elsewhere who like a little bit of local colour. I mean, that's why they want to read books about Scotland, is to get some of the local colour and to get some inside information on the country. So they're actually thrilled to learn new words. And one of the big highs for me as a writer was when the Oxford English Dictionary, the new edition, when it came out, used five or six of the words in my books, and actually, you know, put little footnotes to say that they'd actually come from Ian Rankin novels. So these sort of dialect words that I'm using, some of them have not been used before in written down. They've only been used in oral tradition. Now they've been written down in my books, and they now appear in the official Oxford English Dictionary.
Oh, that's wonderful. Congratulations. Flesh Market Alley, as we get into the story, we run early on into Steve Hawley, who's an interesting character, and we never quite know if he's going to live from book to book, if Rebus is going to...
Yeah, I never know if any of my characters are going to live from book to book either.
Yeah, so when Hawley shows up, you know trouble's coming. And...
I'm always interested in there are always people from the media in my books, whether it be TV. In Black and Blue, there's a TV documentary crew who are hunting down Rebus to try and accuse him of having botched a case. I often use journalists. I've got two or three that I've used in the past. I think all writers have got ambivalent attitudes towards the media in general, and quite a few of us, myself included, have worked in the media before we became novelists. I used to review books for a newspaper. I used to write. I was deputy editor of a music and hi-fi magazine in London, a national magazine. So I've kind of seen it from the other side of the fence. And I know from talking to cops and from talking to journalists that there's a very ambivalent attitude between those two professions.
Sure. Now, in Flesh Market Alley, part of the story is it's an immigration problem. It's asylum seeking, and it involves some unethical businessmen that are subletting apartments out in Flesh Market Alley, and that's a real problem, isn't it?
Well, as with most of my books, the majority of my books, this kicked off with a real life incident, a real crime. An asylum seeker was murdered on the streets of Glasgow, not Edinburgh, but Glasgow, stabbed to death in what was basically just a race crime, a hate crime. And it got me thinking, because I'd already been thinking about the who are the Scots? I mean, it's a big question of identity at the moment, because we've got our new parliament, we've got a certain measure of autonomy from the government in London, we can make a lot of our own decisions. We're starting to ask ourselves, well, why do we need this? Why do we deserve this? What makes us different from the English? Why are we a race apart? Are we different philosophically? Is it the way we look at the world? Is it our language, our culture? What makes us different? And, you know, we've been talking a lot in Scotland about the diaspora, about the fact that Scots have always gone overseas and set up colonies and gone to other countries. And we've always thought of ourselves as being very welcoming to outside cultures as well, unless you were English, is obviously that old antagonism there. That's been exploded, you know. We used to say there's no room for racism in Scotland. We're too busy with religious bigotry, too busy with the Catholics and the Protestants knocking hell out of each other to have any room for racism. But this starving brought it home to us that we do. And from that, I got thinking about there's an asylum seeker detention centre in Scotland, which I based mine on in the book very closely. I just started thinking about the whole issue of race and who are we and how racist are we. So it started with a real life incident, and I just extrapolated from that so I could argue some of the issues or put some of the issues forward to readers without them being aware that they were having to question their own attitudes. The nice thing about the mystery genre is that readers are too busy enjoying that roller coaster ride to notice that they're actually being asked big moral questions about the world and about themselves and their part in society. So that we managed to write, I think, proper literature. Without flagging it up as such, without actually saying to the reader, this is, you know, you are now reading great literature. I think the best crime novels do that without actually making a song and dance about it.
Yes, I agree with you, and I think this is a golden age of crime and mystery writing right now. I think there's some incredible writing going on all over the world in the genre, and I'm thrilled to see it getting the respect it deserves.
It's been a slow haul, especially in the UK. I mean, in the UK, there's this kind of snobbery that says, oh, you know, crime fiction means Agatha Christie, it means bodies in libraries and obscure poisons, and it all takes place in an idyllic English village landscape. Well, look, the crime novel's moved on a long way, even in the UK from there. It's urban fiction, it's about contemporary society, it's about the problems we've got and the mess we're in, and maybe suggesting some ways we can get out of that mess. And now crime fiction finally is starting to be taken seriously. You can study my books in high school. You can study crime fiction at university. There's a professor at St. Andrews University has written a book about my books, which is a very weird experience. And crime fiction is starting to be taken more seriously by the quote-unquote literary establishment.
Good. Yes, I'm thrilled to see that too. Let's talk about Siobhan for a moment again. And it seems to me that you probably have a certain percentage of your readers that think that Rebus and Siobhan should have some type of relationship, but they just absolutely cannot, can they? I mean, it just seems to me there's two things that couldn't happen. They couldn't have a relationship, and Rebus can't start taking antidepressants.
he does take antidepressants. They're called cigarettes. No, they couldn't. I mean, I've thought about it. I mean, in some ways, you know, in a fiction series, you've got two detectives who are very close to each other. They're opposite sex. They're heterosexual. You know, one easy, lazy way to do it is to put them into bed together. It would be a disaster for them professionally and personally. Rebus would be hopeless in bed. It's not realistic. She's half his age, for God's sake. It's a middle-aged man's fantasy. You know, and afterwards it would just screw up, if you'll pardon the phrase, it would screw up their entire working relationship because it would always be in the background and hanging over them. So it ain't going to happen. I mean, his attitude to her, I mean, it's almost like a father and daughter thing. I mean,
yes.
Okay, I mean, he cares for her in a way that's slightly different from that. But he does care for her a hell of a lot. But it's never going to go anywhere sexual, believe me. And, you know, I mean, I think she's astute enough to know that she would never let it go there anyway, no matter how drunk he gets and how many lunges he might make her.
Yeah. And she's pretty good at she can take care of herself. Now,
Siobhan has had very bad taste in men in the past. She's fallen for the wrong guy several times, and I think she's learned from all these experiences. I mean, that's another nice thing about the modern crime novel, as contrasted to the original Golden Age detective story, is that your characters, your central characters, are allowed to evolve, to change, to mature as the series progresses. They don't just get older, they actually remember every case, every murder case that Rebus has worked on has had an impact on him, an effect on him that doesn't go away when the book finishes. So that his head is full of ghosts. His head is full of the ghosts of victims, old cases, and criminals he's put away. And, you know, Miss Marple could blithely go from one book to the next, never having learned anything.
Yes.
And I think that's a central change, which actually makes the crime novel in the modern day, I think, more relevant And makes it more like literature, because the problem that the literary establishment has always had with the crime novel is that everything is too tidy and neatly resolved at the end. And again, we're beginning to learn to leave some loose ends hanging, because real life ain't as cut and dried as we sometimes make it out to be.
Right. And it seems to me that one of the most intimate things that Rebus and Chabon share is music. And on page 254 of Flesh Market Alley, Rebus is in Caro Quinn's house, and he looks at a record collection, and this is a quote, all vinyl, no CDs. There were albums he hadn't seen in years, Steppenwolf, Santana, the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And I've got to tell you, I had to put the bookmark in for a second because I was laughing out loud, because I don't know how long it's been since I thought about the Mahavishnu Orchestra. John McLaughlin's Jan Hammer and Jean-Luc Ponty, and I understand there's actually, on your website, there's actually a musical reference to the Rebus novels, isn't there?
Well, there's a fan of the books, and what he has done is he has collated every musical reference in the books, and he's got his own website called Exile on Princes Street, Princes Street being the main street in Edinburgh, and that being a reference, of course, to the Stones album. And he's just collated every single musical mention in the books, and it's quite a lot of fun. I mean, what's fun for me is, I mean, lots of reasons for being lots of music in my books. Number one, I always want to be a rock and roll star.
Sure.
At the age of 10, I want to be a rock and roll star. Never going to happen. So I can do it in the books. I can use music in the books. Number two, it means that my CD and album collection is a tax-deductible expense because I use it so much for research purposes.
Sure.
Well, that's what I tell the internal revenue anyway. Number three is that I think it delineates character. You know, you can tell a lot about a person from their musical taste. You can tell a lot about Rebus. You can tell his age, his social background and everything from the kind of music he listens to. You can tell that he's not a gregarious guy who gets together with his friends because he listens to stuff like Leonard Cohen late at night. So that's another reason for doing it. And then also it means that I get to meet lots of musicians because they get a kick out of it. I mean, two out of the three members of REM are fans of the books. Hawkwind, the English psychedelic band, are fans. Wishbone Ash, the website there, they're always talking about the Rebus novels. It's great. And just recently I got an email from a fan of mine who happens to be called Pete Townsend, who, of course, is the leader of The Who.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's a thrill. You know, I was thinking, it was interesting. I saw Robert Crace on the Today Show this morning, and they were talking about the Elvis Cole series, which is another great series. And he was saying that he doesn't know if he wants a movie made because then people want to figure, then they'll assign whatever actor they assign to that role. That's what they're going to think of when they read the books. And when you think of Rebus, I'm sure it would be interesting to get like a police sketch artist, what I think he looks like, what you think he looks like, and what your other readers think he looks like. It would probably, we'd probably come up with 100 different ways that this, that Rebus would look.
Yeah, I never describe him physically in the books. He never looks in a mirror and tells you what he sees, because I really don't know what he looks like. The books have been filmed. Several of them were filmed a couple of years ago with an actor called John Hannah, who you might know from Four Weddings and a Funeral, where he read the poem at the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
He was also in a TV series called McCallum. Now, they were shown in the States last year on BBC America. He was a bit young and a bit good-looking and maybe a little bit too kind of soft for the part. He's now ceded control of it, and they're starting to film again with another actor called Ken Stott, who's Edinburgh-born, got a real lived-in-looking face, looks like he's been through a few wars in his time, and I think he should be a fairly good Rebus. But I won't watch it. I mean, I never watched the original series when John Hannah was in it, because I don't want actors' voices and actors' faces getting into my head and interfering with my concept of the characters.
Well, I've got an idea. I was thinking, since you've named some of the books after Rolling Stones titles, I was thinking maybe you could get Keith Richards to put on about 50 pounds and get him all beefed up and some new blood in there. And you might have,
you know, I'd rather get Johnny Depp to do it the way he did it in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah. But yeah, I could see why you would stay away from the TV and the movie part of it, because you know, you do, once you do see a character like that, it's hard to keep that out of your mind.
Yeah, it's true.
Let's talk about your short stories for a moment, because a lot of people, I'm sure, have read all of the Rebus novels, and you've written a couple short story collections, one of them, A Good Hanging. And if someone were to ask you, should I start with Flesh Market Alley? Well, first of all, you can read Flesh Market Alley, Resurrection Man, which won the Edgar Award for Best Mystery Novel. you can read them all standalone. It is nice to go back and start at the start once you've developed an interest in the series. But I think A Good Hanging is a good way to get to know John Rebus as well.
Yeah, A Good Hanging was 12 short stories, one for each month of the year. So each story takes place in a different month. And it's just a kind of year's worth of Edinburgh stuff. You know, the festival is in there, the New Year celebrations are in there, rugby internationals that go on. It's a year's worth of Edinburgh. And it was a way of exploring little bits of Edinburgh and little bits of Rebus that I couldn't do in the novels. They're quite light. They're not, you know, it's not 12 murders, because there ain't 12 murders a year in Edinburgh. So I had to think of other challenges for the short story. Kidnappings, blackmail, suicides, you know, things that were still crime-related but weren't just necessarily murders. So it was a lot of fun to write that series, and I have written quite a few Rebus stories since, and there's a collected short stories coming out fairly soon in the UK, which has a brand new Rebus story in it, which I enjoyed writing.
Our guest today has been Ian Rankin, author of the best-selling Inspector Rebus series. Flesh Market Alley is currently available in bookstores published by Little Brown. Go out and buy it and read it, and read them all. Ian, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today.
Casey, it's been a pleasure, sir. Good luck to you.
Thank you.